Wolf Hall, Disc 14.
Some consultation, and they let him through. "Sir," she says, "could you try again to find the Cardinal, if I were to make an offering?" She shrugs. One of the Franciscans says, "It would have to be a substantial offering." "Your name is?" "I am Father Risby." "I can no doubt meet your expectations. I am a wealthy man." "Would you want simply to locate the soul, to help your own prayers? Or were you thinking in terms of a chantry, perhaps an endowment?" "Whatever you recommend. But of course, I'd need to know he wasn't in hell. There'll be no point throwing away good masses on a hopeless case." "I'll have to talk to Father Bocking," the girl says.
"Father Bocking is this lady's spiritual director."
He inclines his head.
"Come again and ask me," the girl says.
She turns and is lost in the crowd. He parts with some money there and then to the entourage, for Father Bocking, whoever he may be. As it seems, Father Bocking does the price list and keeps the accounts. The nun has plunged the king into gloom. How would you feel if you were told you'd be struck by lightning? By evening he complains of a headache, a pain in his face and jaw. "Go away," he tells his doctors. "You could never cure it, so why should you now?" "And you, madam," he says to Anne, "have your ladies put you to bed. I do not want chatter. I cannot stand piercing voices." Norfolk grumbles under his breath. The Tudor, always something the matter with him. At Austin Friars, if anyone gets a sniffle or a sprain, the boys perform an interlude called "If Norfolk Were Dr. Butts." Got a toothache? Pull them out. Trapped your finger? Hack your hand off. Pain in the head? Slice it off, you've got another. Now Norfolk pauses in backing out of the presence.
"Majesty, she didn't say the lightning would in fact kill you."
"No more did she," Brandon says cheerily.
"Not dead but dethroned. Not dead but stricken and scorched. That's something to look forward to, is it?"
Pitifully indicating his circumstances, the king barks for a servant to bring logs and a page to warm some wine.
"Am I to sit here, the King of England, with a miserable fire and nothing to drink?"
He does look cold. He says,
"She saw my lady mother."
"Your Majesty," he says, cautious, "you know that in the cathedral one of the windows has an image of your lady mother in glass. And would not the sun shine through, so it would seem as if she was in a dazzle of light? I think that's what the nun has seen."
"You don't believe these visions?"
"I think perhaps she can't tell what she sees in the outside world from what is inside her head. Some people are like that. She is to be pitied, perhaps, though not too much." The king frowns.
"But I loved my mother," he says. Then, "Buckingham set much store by visions. He had a friar who prophesied for him. Told him he would be king."
He does not need to add, Buckingham was a traitor and is more than 10 years dead. When the court sails for France, he's in the king's party on the Swallow. He stands on deck watching England recede with the Duke of Richmond, Henry's bastard, excited to be on his first sea voyage and to be in his father's company too. Fitzroy is a handsome boy of 13, fair-haired, tall for his age but slender. Henry, as he must have been as a young prince, and endowed with a proper sense of himself and his own dignity.
"Master Cromwell," he says, "I have not seen you since the Cardinal came down." A moment's awkwardness. "I am glad you prosper, because it is said in the book called The Courtier that in men of base degree we often see high gifts of nature."
"You read Italian, sir?"
"No, but parts of that book have been put into English for me. It is a very good book for me to read."
A pause.
"I wish,"
He turns his head, lowering his voice.
I wish the Cardinal were not dead, because now the Duke of Norfolk is my guardian.
And I hear your Grace is to marry his daughter Mary.
Yes, I do not want to.
Why not?
I have seen her. She has no breasts.
But she has a good wit, my lord. And time may remedy the other matter before you live together. If your people will translate for you that part of Castiglione's book that relates to gentlewomen and their qualities, I'm sure you will find that Mary Howard has all of them. Let's hope, he thinks, it won't turn out like Harry Percy's match, or George Boleyn's. For the girl's sake, too. Castiglione says that everything that can be understood by men can be understood by women, that their apprehension is the same, their faculties, no doubt their loves and hates. Castiglione was in love with his wife Ippolita, but she died when he had only had her 4 years. He wrote a poem for her, an elegy, but he wrote it as if Ippolita was writing, the dead woman speaking to him. In the ship's wake, the gulls cry like lost souls. The king comes on deck and says his headache has cleared. He says, Majesty, we were talking of Castiglione's book. You have found time to read it?
Indeed. He extols prezzatura, the art of doing everything gracefully and well, without the appearance of effort. A quality princes should cultivate, too, he adds, rather dubious. King Francis has it.
Yes, but besides prezzatura, one must exhibit at all times a dignified public restraint. I was thinking I might commission a translation as a gift for my Lord Norfolk. It must be in his mind, the picture of Thomas Howard in Canterbury, threatening to punch the holy nun. Henry grins. You should do it. Well, if he would not take it as a reproach, Castiglione recommends that a man should not curl his hair nor pluck his eyebrows. And you know my lord does both. The princeling frowns at him.
My lord of Norfolk.
Henry unleashes an unregal yell of laughter, neither dignified nor restrained. It is welcome to his ears. The ship's timbers creak. The king steadies himself with a hand on his shoulder. The wind stiffens the sails. The sun dances over the water. An hour, and we will be in port. Calais, this outpost of England, her last hold on France, is a town where he has many friends, many customers, many clients. He knows it. Watergate and Lantern Gate, St. Nicholas Church and Church of Our Lady. He knows its towers and bulwarks, its markets, courts and quays. Staple Inn, where the governor lodges, and the houses of the Wet Hill and Wingfield families, houses with shady gardens where gentlemen live in pleasant retreat from an England they claim they no longer understand. He knows the fortifications, crumbling, and beyond the city walls the lands of the Pale, its woods, villages and marshes, its sluices, dikes and canals. He knows the road to Boulogne and the road to Gravelines, which is the Emperor's territory, and he knows that either monarch, Francis or Charles, could take this town with one determined push. The English have been here for 200 years, but in the streets now you hear more French and Flemish spoken. The governor greets His Majesty. Lord Berners, old soldier and scholar, is the pattern of old-fashioned virtue, and if it were not for his limp and his evident anxiety about the vast expenses he's about to incur, he will be straight out of the book called The Courtier. He's even arranged to lodge the king and the marquis in rooms with an interconnecting door. I think that will be very suitable, my lord, he says, as long as there is a sturdy bolt on both sides. Because Mary told him before they left dry land. Till now, she wouldn't, but now she would, but he won't. He tells her he must be sure that if she gets a child, it's born in wedlock. The monarchs are to meet for 5 days in Boulogne, then 5 days in Calais. Anne is aggrieved at the thought of being left behind.
He can see by her restlessness that she knows this is a debatable land, where things might happen you cannot foretell. Meanwhile, he has private business to transact. He leaves even Rafe behind and slips away to an inn in a back court of Corkwell Street. It is a low sort of place and smells of wood smoke, fish and mould. On a side wall is a watery mirror, through which he glimpses his own face, pale, only his eyes alive. For a moment it shocks him. You do not expect to see your own image in a hovel like this. He sits at a table and waits. After 5 minutes, there is a disturbance of the air at the back of the room, but nothing happens. He has anticipated they will keep him waiting. To pass the time, he runs over in his head the figures for last year's receipts to the king from the Duchy of Cornwall. He's about to move on to the figures submitted by the Chamberlain of Chester when a dark shape materialises and resolves itself into the person of an old man in a long gown. He totters forward, and in time two others follow him. You could change any one for the other. Hollow coughs, long beards. According to some precedents which they negotiate by grunting, they take their seats on a bench opposite. He hates alchemists. And these look like alchemists to him. Nameless splashes on their garments, watering eyes, vapour-induced sniffles. He greets them in French. They shudder. And one of them asks in Latin if they are not going to have anything to drink. He calls for the boy and asks him without much hope what he suggests. Drink somewhere else, the boy offers. A jug of something vinegary comes. He lets the old man drink deeply before he asks, which of you is Maitre Camillo? They exchange glances. It takes them as long as it takes the grey eye to pass their single shared eye. Maitre Camillo has gone to Venice. Why? Some coughing. For consultations. But he does mean to return to France.
Quite likely.
The thing you have, I want it for my master. A silence. How would it be, he thought, if I take the wine away till they say something useful? But one preempts him, snatching up the jug. His hand shakes and the wine washes over the table. The others bleat with irritation. I thought you might bring drawings, he says. They look at each other.
Oh, no.
But there are drawings.
Not as such.
The spilt wine begins to soak into the splintered wood. They sit in miserable silence and watch this happen. One of them occupies himself in working his finger through a moth hole in his sleeve. He shouts to the boy for a second jug.
We do not wish to disoblige you, the spokesman says. You must understand that Maitre Camillo is, for now, under the protection of King Francis.
He intends to make a model for him.
That is possible.
A working model?
Any model would be, by its nature, a working model.
Should he find the terms of his employment in the least unsatisfactory, my master Henry would be happy to welcome him in England. There is another pause, till the jug is fetched and the boy has gone. This time he does the pouring himself. The old men exchange glances again, and one says,
the Magister believes he would dislike the English climate. The fogs, and also the whole island, is covered with witches.
The interview has been unsatisfactory, but one must begin somewhere. As he leaves, he says to the boy, you might go and swab the table.
I may as well wait till they've upset the second jug, monsieur.
True. Take them in some food. What do you have?
Pottage. I won't recommend it. It looks like what's left when a horse washed a shift.
I never knew the Calais girls to wash anything. Can you read?
A little.
Write?
No, monsieur.
You should learn. Meanwhile, use your eyes. If anyone else comes to talk to them, if they bring out any drawings, parchments, scrolls, anything of that kind, I want to know. The boy says, "What is it, monsieur? What are they selling?" He almost tells him. What harm could it do? But then, in the end, he can't think of the right words.
Partway through the talks in Boulogne, he has a message that Francis would like to see him.
Henry deliberates before giving him permission. Face to face, monarchs should deal only with fellow monarchs, and lords and churchmen of high rank. Since they landed, Brandon and Howard, who were friendly enough on board ship, have been distant with him, as if to make it quite clear to the French that they accord him no status. He is some whim of Henry's, they pretend, a novelty counsellor who will soon vanish in favour of a viscount, baron, or bishop. The French messenger tells him,
"This is not an audience."
"No," he says, "I understand. Nothing of that sort." Francis sits waiting, attended only by a handful of courtiers, for what is not an audience. He is a beanpole of a man, his elbows and knees jutting at the air, his big bony feet restless inside vast padded slippers.
"Cromwell," he says, "now let me understand you. You are a Welshman."
"No, Your Highness." Sorrowful dog eyes. They look him over. They look him over again.
"Not a Welshman."
He sees the French King's difficulty. How has he got his passport to the court, if he is not from some family of humble Tudor retainers? "It was the late Cardinal who induced me into the King's business."
"Yes, I know that," Francis says. "But I think to myself, there is something else going on here."
"That may be, Highness," he says crisply, "but it's certainly not being Welsh." Francis touches the tip of his pendulous nose, bending it further towards his chin. "Choose your prince. You wouldn't like to look at this one every day. Henry is so wholesome in his fleshy, scrubbed pink and whiteness." Francis says, his glance drifting away,
"They say you once fought for the honour of France."
Guerrigliano. For a moment he lowers his eyes, as if he's remembering a very bad accident in the street, some mashing and irretrievable mangling of limbs, on a most unfortunate day.
"Still, these things pass. Who now remembers Agincourt?"
He almost laughs. "It is true," he says. "A generation or two, or three, or four, and these things are nothing." Francis says,
"They say you are in very good standing with that lady."
He sucks his lip.
"Tell me, I'm curious, what does my brother King think?
Does he think she's a maid?"
"Myself, I never tried her. When she was here at court, she was young and as flat as a board. Her sister, however..."
He would like to stop him, but you can't stop a king. His voice runs over naked Mary, chin to toes, and then flips her over like a griddle cake and does the other side, nape to heels. An attendant hands him a square of fine linen, and as he finishes, he dabs the corner of his mouth and hands the kerchief back.
"Well enough," Francis says. "I see you will not admit to being Welsh, so that is the end of my theories."
Corners of his mouth turn up. His elbows work a little. His knees twitch. The not audience is over.
"Monsieur Cromwell," he says, "we may not meet again. Your sudden fortunes may not last. So come, give me your hand like a soldier of France, and put me in your prayers."
He bows. "Your beadsman, sir." As he leaves, one of the courtiers steps forward and, murmuring,
"A gift from His Highness,"
hands him a pair of embroidered gloves. Another man, he supposes, would be pleased and try them on. For his part, he pinches the fingers
and finds what he's looking for. Gently he shakes the glove, his hand cupped. He goes straight to Henry. He finds him in the sunshine, playing a game of bowls with some French lords. Henry can make a game of bowls as noisy as a tournament. Whooping, groaning, shouting of odds, wails, oaths. The king looks up at him, his eyes saying, "Well?" His eyes say, "Alone." The king say, "Later." And not a word is spoken. But all the time the king keeps up his joking and backslapping. And he straightens up, watching his wood glide over the shorn grass, and points in his direction. "You see this counsellor of mine? I warn you, never play any game with him, for he will not respect your ancestry. He has no coat of arms and no name, but he believes he is bred to win." One of the French lords says, "To lose gracefully is an art that every gentleman cultivates." "I hope to cultivate it too," he says. "If you see an example I might follow, please point it out." For they are all, he notices, intent on winning this game, on taking a piece of gold from the King of England. Gambling is not a vice, if you can afford to do it. Perhaps I could issue him with gaming tokens, he thinks, redeemable only if presented in person at some office in Westminster, with tortuous paperwork attached, and fees to clerks, and a special seal to be affixed. That will save us some money. But the king's wood moves smoothly towards the marker ball. Henry is winning the game anyway. From the French, a spatter of polite applause. When he and the king are alone, he says, "Here's something you will like." Henry likes surprises. With a thick forefinger, his pink, clean English nail, he nudges the ruby about on the back of his hand. "It is a good stone," he says. "I'm a judge of these things." A pause. "Who is the principal goldsmith here? Ask him to wait on me. It's a dark stone. Francis will know it again. I will wear it on my own finger before our meetings are done. France shall see how I am served." He is in high good humour. "However, I shall give you the value." He nods to dismiss him. "Of course, you will compound with the goldsmith to put a higher valuation on it and arrange to split the profit with him. But I shall be liberal in the matter."
"Arrange your face."
The king laughs. "Why would I trust a man with my business if he could not manage his own? One day Francis will offer you a pension. You must take it. By the way, what did he ask you?" "He asked if I were Welsh. It seemed a great question with him. I was sorry to be so disappointing." "Oh, you are not disappointing," Henry says. "But the moment you are, I will let you know."
2 hours, 2 kings.
"What do you know, Walter?" He stands in the salty air, talking to his dead father. When Francis comes back with his brother King to Calais, it is Anne who leads him out to dance after the evening's great feast. There is colour in her cheeks, and her eyes sparkle behind her gilded mask. When she lowers the mask and looks at the King of France, she wears a strange half-smile, not quite human, as if behind the mask were another mask. You can see his jaw drop. You can see him begin to drool. She entwines her fingers with his and leads him to a window seat. They speak in French for an hour, whispering, his sleek dark head leaning towards her. Sometimes they laugh, looking into each other's eyes. No doubt they are discussing the new alliance. He seems to think she has another treaty tucked down her bodice. Once Francis lifts her hand. She pulls back, half resisting, and for one moment it seems he intends to lay her little fingers upon his unspeakable codpiece. Everyone knows that Francis has recently taken the mercury cure, but no one knows if it has worked. Henry is dancing with the wives of Calais notables, Gigue, Saltarello, Charles Brandon, his sick wife forgotten,
is making his partners scream by throwing them in the air so that their skirts fly up. But Henry's glance keeps straying down the hall to Anne, to Francis. His spine is stiff with his personal terror. His face expresses smiling agony. Finally, he thinks, I must end this. Can it be true, he wonders, that as a subject should, I really love my king? He ferrets Norfolk out of the dark corner where he's hiding, for fear that he should be commanded to partner the governor's wife. My lord, fetch your niece away. She has done enough diplomacy. Our king is jealous. What? What the devil is his complaint now? Yet Norfolk sees at a glance what is happening. He swears and crosses the room. Through the dancers, not round them, he takes Anne by her wrist, bending it back as if to snap it. By your leave, Highness. My lady, we shall dance. He jerks her to her feet. Dance they do, though it bears no relation to any dance seen in any hall before this. On the Duke's part, a thundering with demon hooves. On her part, a blanched caper, one arm held like a broken wing. He looks across at Henry. The king's face expresses a sober, righteous satisfaction. Anne should be punished. And by whom except her kin? The French lords huddle together, sniggering. Francis looks on with narrowed eyes. That night, the king withdraws from company early, dismissing even the gentlemen of his privy chamber. Only Henry Norris is in and out, trailed by an underling carrying wine, fruit, a large quilt, then a pan of coals. It has turned chilly. The women, in their turn, have become brisk and snappish. Anne's raised voice has been heard. Doors slam. As he is talking to Thomas Wyatt, Mr. Shelton comes careering towards him.
My lady wants a Bible.
Master Cromwell can recite the whole Testament, Wyatt says helpfully. The girl looks agonized.
I think she wants it to swear on.
In that case, I'm no use to her. Wyatt catches her hands. Who's going to keep you warm tonight, young Shelton? She pulls away from him, shoots off in pursuit of the scriptures. I'll tell you who. Henry Norris. He looks after the girl. She draws lots. I've been lucky. The king?
Perhaps.
Recently? Anne would pull out their hearts and roast them. He feels he should not go far, in case Henry calls for him. He finds a corner for a game of chess with Edward Seymour. Between moves, your sister Jane, he says.
Odd little creature, isn't she?
What age would she be?
I don't know, 20 or so.
She walked around at Wolf Hall saying, these are Thomas Cromwell's sleeves. Nobody knew what she was talking about, he laughs, very pleased with herself. Has your father made a match for her?
There was some talk of...
He looks up.
Why do you ask?
Just distracting you. Tom Seymour bursts through the door.
Good evening, Grandpa,
he shouts at his brother. He knocks his cap off and ruffles his hair.
There are women waiting for us. My friend here advises not.
Edward dusts his cap.
He says they're just the same as English women, but dirtier.
Voice of experience, Tom says. Edward resettles his cap primly.
How old would our sister Jane be?
21?
22? Why?
Edward looks down at the board, reaches for his queen. He sees how he's trapped. He glances up in appreciation.
How did you manage that?
Later, he sits with a blank piece of paper before him. He means to write a letter to Cranmer and cast it to the four winds, send it searching through Europe. He picks up his pen, but does not write. He revisits in his mind his conversation with Henry about the ruby. His king imagines he would take part in a backstairs deceit, the kind that might have entertained him in the days when he antiqued cupids and sold them to cardinals. But to defend yourself against such accusations makes you seem guilty. If Henry does not fully trust him, is it surprising? A prince is alone,
in his council chamber, in his bedchamber, and finally in Hell's antechamber, stripped, as Harry Percy said, for judgment. This visit has compacted the court's quarrels and intrigues, trapped them in the small space within the town's walls, and travellers have become as intimate with each other as cards in a pack. Contiguous, but their paper eyes blind. He wonders where Tom Wyatt is, and in what sort of trouble. He doesn't think he can sleep, though not because he's worried about Wyatt. He goes to the window. The moon, as if disgraced, trails rags of black cloud. In the gardens, torches burn in wall brackets, but he walks away from the light. The faint push and pull of the ocean is steady and insistent as his own heartbeat. He knows he shares this darkness, and within a moment there is a footstep, a rustle of skirts, a faint breathy gulp, a hand sliding on his arm. "You," Mary says.
"Me?"
"Do you know they unbolted the door between them?" She laughs, a merciless giggle. "She is in his arms, naked as she was born. She can't change her mind now."
"Tonight I thought they would quarrel."
"They did. They like quarrelling. She claims Norfolk has broken her arm. Henry called her a Magdalene and some other names I forget. I think they were Roman ladies, not Lucrece."
"No, at least I hope not. What does she want the Bible for?"
"To swear him, before witnesses, me, Norris. He made a binding promise. They are married in God's sight, and he swears he will marry her again in England and crown her queen when spring comes."
He thinks of the nun at Canterbury. "If you enter into a form of marriage with this unworthy woman, you will not reign 7 months."
"So now," Mary says, "it is just a question of whether he will find he is able to do the deed."
"Mary," he takes her hand, "don't frighten me."
"Henry is timid. He thinks you expect a kingly performance. But if he is shy, Anne will know how to help." She adds carefully, "I mean to say I have advised her." She slides her hand onto his shoulder. "So now, what about us? It has been a weary struggle to bring them here. I think we have earned our recreation."
No answer.
"You're not still frightened of my Uncle Norfolk?"
"Mary, I am terrified of your Uncle Norfolk."
"Still, that's not the reason, not the reason why he hesitates, not quite pulling away." Her lips brush his. She asks,
"What are you thinking?"
"I was thinking that if I were not the king's most dutiful servant, it would be possible to be on the next boat out."
"Where would we go?"
"He doesn't remember inviting a friend." "East. Though I grant this would not be a good starting point. East of the Boleyns," he thinks. "East of everybody." He is thinking of the Middle Sea, not these northern waters. And one night especially, a warm midnight in a house in Larnaca. Venetian lights spilling out onto the dangerous waterfront. The slap of slave feet on tiles. A perfume of incense and coriander. He puts an arm around Mary, encountering something soft, totally unexpected. Fox fur. "Clever of you," he says.
"Oh, we brought everything, every stitch, in case we're here till winter."
A glow of light on flesh. Her throat very white, very soft. All things seem possible if the Duke stays indoors. Her fingertip teases out the fur till fur meets flesh. Her shoulder is warm, centred and a little damp. He can feel the bounce of her pulse. A sound behind him. He turns, dagger in hand. Mary screams, pulls at his arm. The point of the weapon comes to rest against a man's doublet under the breastbone.
All right," says a sober, irritated English voice. "Put that away."
"Heavens," Mary says, "you almost murdered William Stafford."
He backs the stranger into the light. When he sees his face, not till then, he draws back the blade. He doesn't know who Stafford is. Somebody's horsekeeper,
"William, I thought you weren't coming," Mary says.
"If I didn't, it seems you had a reserve."
"You don't know what a woman's life is. You think you've fixed something with a man and you haven't. He says he'll meet you and he doesn't turn up."
It is a cry from the heart. "Give you good night," he says. Mary turns as if to say, "Oh, don't go." "Time I said my prayers." A wind has blown up from the narrow sea, snapping at the rigging in the harbour, rattling the windows inland. Tomorrow he thinks it may rain. He lights a candle and goes back to his letter. But his letter has no attraction for him. Leaves flurry from the gardens, from the orchards. Images move in the air beyond the glass, gulls blown like ghosts. A flash of his wife Elizabeth's white cap as she follows him to the door on her last morning, except that she didn't. She was sleeping, wrapped in damp linen, under the yellow turkey quilt. If he thinks of the fortune that brought him here, he thinks equally of the fortune that brought him to that morning 5 years ago, going out of Austin Friars, a married man, files of Woolsey's business under his arm. Was he happy then? He doesn't know. That night in Cyprus, long ago now, he had been on the verge of handing his resignation to his bank, or at least of asking them for letters of introduction to take him east. He was curious to see the Holy Land, its plant life and people, to kiss the stones where the disciples had walked, to bargain in the hidden quarters of strange cities and in black tents where veiled women scuttle like cockroaches into corners. That night, his fortunes had been in equipoise. In the room behind him, as he looked out over the harbour lights, he heard a woman's throaty laughter, her soft "Alhamdulillah," as she shook the ivory dice in her hand. He heard her spill them, heard them rattle and come to rest. What is it? East is high, west is low. Gambling is not a vice if you can afford to do it. It is 3-3. Is that low? You must say it is. Fate has not given him a shove, more of a gentle tap. I shall go home. Not tonight, though. It is too late for the tide. Next day he felt the gods at his back like a breeze. He turned back towards Europe. Home then was a narrow, shuttered house on a quiet canal, and Selma kneeling, creamily naked under her trailing nightgown of green damask, its sheen blackish in candlelight, kneeling before the small silver altarpiece she kept in her room, which was precious to her, she had told him, "the most precious thing I own." "Excuse me just a moment," she had said to him. She prayed in her own language, now coaxing, now almost threatening, and she must have teased from her silver saints some flicker of grace, or perceived some deflection in their glinting rectitude, because she stood up and turned to him, saying, "I'm ready now," tugging apart the silk ties of her gown so that he could take her breasts in his hands. Chapter 3. Early Mass. November 1532. Rafe is standing over him, saying it's 7 o'clock already. The king has gone to Mass. He has slept in a bed of phantoms. "We did not want to wake you. You never sleep late." The wind is a muted sigh in the chimneys. A handful of rain like gravel rattles against the window, swirls away, and is thrown back again. "We may be in Calais for some time," he says. When Wolsey had gone to France 5 years ago, he had asked him to watch the situation at court and to pass on a report of when the king and Anne went to bed. He had said, "How will I know when it happens?" The cardinal had said, "I shall think you'll know by his face." The wind has dropped, and the rain respited by the time he reaches the church, but the streets have turned to mud, and the people waiting to see the lords come out still have their coats pulled over their heads like a new race of walking decapitees. He pushes through the crowd, then threads and whispers his way through the gathered gentlemen. "S'il vous plaît, c'est urgent. Make way for a big sinner."
They laugh and let him through. Anne comes out on the governor's arm. He looks tense. It seems his gout is troubling him. But he is attentive to her, murmuring pleasantries to which he gets no response. Her expression is adjusted to a careful blankness. The king has a Wingfield lady on his arm, face up-tilted, chattering. He is taking no notice of her at all. He looks large, broad, benign. His regal glance scans the crowd. It alights on him. The king smiles. As he leaves the church, Henry puts on his hat. It is a big hat, a new hat. And in that hat there is a feather.
Part 5, Chapter 1, Anna Regina, 1533. The two children sit on a bench in the hall of Austin Friars. They are so small that their legs stick straight out in front of them, and as they are still in smocks, one cannot tell their sex. Under their caps, their dimpled faces beam. That they look so fat and contented is a credit to the young woman, Helen Barr, who now unwinds the thread of her tale. Daughter of a bankrupt small merchant out of Essex, wife of one Matthew Barr, who beat her and deserted her. "Leaving me," she says, indicating, "with that one in my belly." The neighbours are always coming at him with parish problems, unsafe cellar doors, a noisome goose house, a husband and wife who shout and bang pans all night, so the next house can't get to sleep. He tries not to fret if these things cut into his time, and he minds Helen less than a goose house. Mentally, he takes her out of cheap shrunken wool and redresses her in some figured velvet he saw yesterday, 6 shillings the yard. Her hands, he sees, are skinned and swollen from rough work. He supplies kid gloves.
"Though when I say he deserted me, it may be that he is dead. He was a great drinker and a brawler. A man who knew him told me he came off worst in a fight, and I should seek him at the bottom of the river. But someone else saw him on the quays at Tilbury with a travelling bag. So which am I, wife or widow?"
"I will look into it, though I think you would rather I didn't find him. How have you lived?"
"When he went first, I was stitching for a sailmaker. Since I came up to London to search, I've been hurrying out by the day. I've been in the laundry at a convent near Paul's, helping at the yearly wash of their bed linen. They find me a good worker. They say they will give me a pallet in the attics, but they won't take the children."
Another instance of the church's charity. He runs up against them all the time. "We cannot have you a slave to a set of hypocrite women. You must come here. I am sure you will be useful. The house is filling up all the time, and I am building, as you see." She must be a good girl, he thinks, to turn her back on making a living in the obvious way. If she walked along the street, she wouldn't be short of offers. "They tell me you would like to learn to read, so you can read the gospel."
"Some women I met took me to what they call a night school. It was in a cellar at Broadgate. Before that, I knew Noah, the three kings and Father Abraham, but St. Paul I'd never heard of. At home on our farm we had pucks who used to turn the milk and blow up thunderstorms, but I'm told they're not Christians. I wish we had stayed farming for all that. My father was no hand at town life."
Her eyes, anxious, follow the children. They've launched themselves off the bench and toddled across the flagstones to see the picture that's growing on the wall, and their every step causes her to hold her breath. The workman is a German, a young boy Hans recommended for a simple job, and he turns around, he speaks no English, to explain to the children what he's doing. A rose, three lions, see them jump, two blackbirds.
"Red!"
the elder child cries.
"She knows colours," Helen says, pink with pride. "She's also beginning on 1, 2, 3.
The space where the arms of Woolsey used to be is being repainted with his own newly granted arms. Asia, on a fest between three lions rampant or a rose gules, barbed vair, between two Cornish chuffs proper. "You see, Helen," he says, "those blackbirds were Woolsey's emblem." He laughs. "There are people who hoped they would never see them again."
"There are other people of our sort who do not understand it."
"You mean night school people?"
"They say, How can a man who loves the gospel have loved such a man as that?
I never liked his haughty manners, you know, and his processions every day, the state he kept. And yet there was never a man more active in the service of England since England began. And also, he says sadly, when you came into his confidence, he was a man of such grace and ease. Helen, can you come here today? He's thinking of those nuns and the yearly wash of their bed linen. He's imagining the cardinal's appalled face. Laundry women followed his train as whores follow an army, hot from their hour-by-hour exertions. At York Place, he had a bath made, deep enough for a man to stand up in it, the room heated by a stove, such as you find in the Low Countries. And many a time he had negotiated business with the cardinal's bobbing, boiled-looking head. Henry has taken it over now, and splashes about in it with favoured gentlemen, who submit to being ducked under the water and half-drowned by their lord, if his mood takes him that way. The painter offers the brush to the elder child. Helen glows.
"Careful, darling," she says.
A blob of blue is applied. "You are a little adept," the painter says.
"Gefällt es Ihnen, Herr Cromwell? Sind Sie stolz darauf?"
He says to Helen, he asks if I am pleased and proud. She says, "If you are not, your friends will be proud for you." I'm also translating, he thinks, if not language to language, then person to person. Anne to Henry, Henry to Anne. Those days when he wants soothing, and she is as prickly as a holly bush. Those times, they do occur, when his gaze strays after another woman, and she follows it, and storms off to her own apartments. He, Cromwell, goes about like some public poet, carrying assurances of desire each to each. 'Tis hardly 3 o'clock, and already the room is half dark. He picks up the younger child, who flops against his shoulder and falls asleep, with the speed at which someone pushed falls off a wall. "Helen," he says, "this household is full of pert young men, and they will all put themselves forward in teaching you to read, bringing you presents and trying to sweeten your days. Do learn and take the presents, and be happy here with us. But if anyone is too forward, you must tell me, or tell Ralph Sadler. He is the boy with the little red beard, though I should not say boy." It will be 20 years soon since he brought Ralph in from his father's house. A lowering dark day like this, rain bucketing from the heavens, the child slumped against his shoulder as he carried him into his hall at Fenchurch Street. The storms had kept them in Calais for 10 days. Ships out of Boulogne were wrecked, Antwerp flooded, much of the countryside put under water. He would like to get messages to his friends, inquiring after their lives and property, but the roads are impassable. Calais itself is a floating island upon which a happy monarch reigns. He goes to the king's lodgings to ask for an audience. A business doesn't stop in bad weather. But he is told, "The king cannot see you this morning. He and Lady Anne are composing some music for the harp." Ralph catches his eye and they walk away. "Let us hope in time they have a little song to show for it." Thomas Wyatt and Henry Norris get drunk together in a low tavern. They swear eternal friendship, but their followers have a fight in the inn yard and roll each other in mud. He never sets eyes on Mary Boleyn. Presumably, she and Stafford have found some bolt hole where they can compose together. By candlelight at noon, Lord Berners shows him his library, limping energetically from desk to desk, handling with care the old folios from which he has made his scholarly translations. Here is a romance of King Arthur. "When I started reading it, I almost gave up the project. It was clear to me it was too fantastical to be true. But little by little, as I read, you know, it appeared to me that there was a moral in this tale." He does not say what it is. "And here is Froissart done into English, which His Majesty himself bade me undertake. I could not do other, for he had just lent me £500. Would you like to see my translations from the Italian? They are private ones. I have not sent them to the printer." He spends an afternoon with the manuscripts, and they discuss them at supper. Lord Berners holds a position, Chancellor of the Exchequer, which Henry has given him for life,
but because he is not in London and attending to it, it does not bring him in much money, or the influence it should.
I know you are a good man for business. Might you in confidence look over my accounts? They're not what you'd call in order.
Lord Berners leaves him alone with the dog's breakfast that he calls his ledgers. An hour passes. The wind whistles across the rooftops. The candle flames tremble. Hail batters the glass. He hears the scrape of his host's bad foot. An anxious face peers around the door.
What joy!
All he can find is money owing. This is what you get for devoting yourself to scholarship and serving the king across the sea, when you could be at court with sharp teeth and eyes and elbows, ready to seize your advantage. I wish you'd called on me earlier. There are always things that can be done.
Ah, but who knew you, Master Cromwell? The old man says. One exchanged letters, yes. Wolsey's business, King's business. But I never knew you. It did not seem at all likely I should know you until now.
On the day they are finally ready to embark, the boy from the Alchemist's Inn turns up.
You at last. What have you got for me?
The boy displays his empty hands and launches into English of a sort.
Indeed, those magi have returned to Paris.
Then I am disappointed.
You are hard to find, monsieur. I go to the place where le Roi Henri and the Grand Putain are lodged. Je cherche my Lord Cromwell. As the persons there laughed at me and beat me.
That is because I am not a milord.
In that case, I do not know what a milord in your country looks like.
He offers the boy a coin for his efforts and another for the beating, but he shakes his head.
I sought to take service with you, monsieur. I have made up my mind to go travelling.
Your name is?
Christophe.
You have a family name?
Ça ne fait rien.
You have parents? A shrug. Your age?
What age would you say?
I know you can read. Can you fight?
There is much fighting chez vous.
Christophe has his own squat build. He needs feeding up, but a year or two from now he will be hard to knock over. He puts him at 15, no more.
You are in trouble with the law?
In France, he says disparagingly,
as one might say in far Cathay.
You are a thief?
The boy makes a jabbing motion, invisible knife in his fist.
You left someone dead.
He didn't look well.
He grins.
You're sure you want Christophe your name? You can change it now, but not later.
You understand me, monsieur?
Christ, of course I do. You could be my son.
Then he looks at him closely, to make sure that he isn't. That he isn't one of these brawling children the cardinal spoke of, whom he's left by the Thames, and not impossibly by other rivers, in other climes. But Christophe's eyes are a wide, untroubled blue.
You are not afraid of the sea voyage? He asks. In my house in London there are many French speakers. You'll soon be one of us.
Now at Austin Friars, Christophe pursues him with questions. Those magi, what is it they have? Is it a cart of buried treasure? Is it, he flaps his arms, the instructions for one to make a flying machine? Is it a machine to fare great explosions, or a military dragon breathes out fire?
He says, have you ever heard of Cicero?
No, but I am prepared to hear of him. Till today I have never heard of Bishop Gardiner. Indeed, you have stole his strawberry beds and give them to the king's mistress, and now he intends...
The boy breaks off, and again gives his impression of a military dragon.
To ruin you utterly and pursue you unto death.
And well beyond, if I know my man.
There have been worse accounts of his situation. He wants to say, she is not a mistress, not any more. But the secret, though it must soon be an open secret, is not his to tell. 25th of January, 1533. Dawn. A chapel at Whitehall. His friend Roland Lee as priest. Anne and Henry take their vows, confirm the contract they made in Calais. Almost in secret, with no celebration, just a huddle of witnesses, the married pair both speechless, except for the small admissions of intent, forced out of them by the ceremony. Henry Norris is pale and sober.
Was it kind to make him witness it twice over, and being given to another man? William Brereton is a witness, as he is in attendance in the King's Privy Chamber. "Are you truly here?" he asks him. "Or are you somewhere else? You gentlemen tell me you can bilocate like great saints." Brereton glares. "You've been writing letters up to Chester. The King's business, how not?" They must do this in a mutter, as Roland joins the hands of bride and groom. "I'll tell you just once, keep away from my family's affairs, or you'll come off worse, Master Cromwell, than you can imagine." Anne is attended by only one lady, her sister. As they leave, the King, towing his wife, hand on her upper arm, towards a little harp music, Mary turns and gives him a sumptuous smile. She holds up her hand, thumb and finger, an inch apart. She had always said, "I will be the first to know. It will be me who lets out her bodices." He calls William Brereton back, politely. He says, "You have made a mistake in threatening me." He goes back to his office in Westminster. He wonders, does the King know yet? Probably not. He sits down to his drafting. They bring in candles. He sees the shadow of his own hand moving across the paper, his own unconcealable fist unmasked by velvet glove. He wants nothing between himself and the weave of the paper, the black running line of ink. So he takes off his rings, Wolsey's turquoise and Francis's ruby. At New Year, the King slid it from his own finger and gave it back to him, in the setting the Calais goldsmith had made, and said, as rulers do, in a rush of confidence, "Now that will be a sign between us, Cromwell. Send a paper with this, and I shall know it comes from your hand, even if you lack your seal." A confidant of Henry's, who was standing by, it was Nicholas Carew, had remarked, "His Majesty's ring fits you without adjustment." He said, "So it does." He hesitates, his quill hovering. He writes, "This realm of England is an empire. This realm of England is an empire, and so has been accepted in the world, governed by one supreme head and king." At 11 o'clock, when the day has brightened as much as it will, he eats dinner with Cranmer in his lodging at Cannon Row, where he is living till his new dignity is conferred and he can move into Lambeth Palace. He has been practising his new signature, Thomas Elect of Canterbury. Soon he will dine in state, but today, like a threadbare scholar, he shoves his papers aside while some table linen is laid, and they bring in the salt fish, over which he signs a grace. "That won't improve it," he says. "Who's cooking for you? I'll send someone over." "So, is the marriage made?" It is like Cranmer to wait to be told, to work 6 hours in silent patience, head down over his books. "Yes, Roland was up to his office. He didn't wed her to Norris, or the King to her sister." He shakes out his napkin. "I know a thing, but you must coax it from me." He's hoping that Cranmer, by way of coaxing, will impart the secret he promised in his letter, the secret written down the side of the page. But it must have been some minor indiscretion, now forgotten. And because Canterbury Elect is occupied in poking uncertainly at scales and skin, he says, "She, Anne, she's already having a child." Cranmer glances up.
"If you tell it in that tone, people will think you take the credit yourself."
"Are you not astonished? Are you not pleased?"
"I wonder what fish this purports to be,"
Cranmer says with mild interest.
"Naturally, I'm delighted. But I knew it, you see, because this marriage is clean. Why would not God bless it with offspring and with an heir?"
"Of course, with an heir. Look." He takes out the papers he has been working on. Cranmer washes his fishy fingers and hunches towards the candle flame.
"So, after Easter," he says, reading, "it will be against the law and the King's prerogative to make an appeal in any matter to the Pope. So there is Catherine's suit dead and buried, and I, Canterbury, can decide the King's cause in our own courts. Well, this has been long enough coming."
He laughs. You were long enough coming. Cranmer was in Mantua when he heard of the honour the king intended for him. He began his journey circuitously. Stephen Vaughan met him at Lyon and hustled him over the winter roads and through the snowdrifts of Picardy to the boat. Why did you delay? Doesn't every boy want to be an archbishop? Though not me, if I think back. What I wanted was my own bear. Cranmer looks at him, his expression speculative. I'm sure that could be arranged for you. Gregory has asked him, how will we know when Dr. Cranmer is making a joke? He has told him you won't. They are as rare as apple blossom in January. And now, for some weeks, he will be half fearful that a bear will turn up at his door. As they part that day, Cranmer glances up from the table and says, Of course, I don't officially know. About the child? About the marriage. As I am to be judge in the matter of the king's old marriage, it would not be proper for me to hear that his new one has already taken place. Right, he says. What Roland gets up to in the early hours of the morning is a matter for himself alone. He leaves Cranmer, with head bowed over the remains of their meal, as if studying to reassemble the fish. As our severance from the Vatican is not yet complete, we cannot have a new archbishop unless the Pope appoints him. Delegates in Rome are empowered to say anything, promise anything, pro tem, to get Clement to agree. The king says aghast, Do you know how much the papal bulls cost for Canterbury? And that I shall have to pay for them? And do you know how much it costs to install him? He adds, It must be done properly, of course. Nothing omitted, nothing scantered. It will be the last money your Majesty sends to Rome, if it rests with me. And do you know, the king says, as if he's discovered something astonishing, that Cranmer has not a penny of his own? He can contribute nothing. He borrows the money, on the crown's behalf, from a rich Genovese he knows called Salvago. To persuade him into the loan, he sends around to his house an engraving which he knows Sebastian covets. It shows a young man standing in a garden, his eyes turned upwards to an empty window, at which it is to be hoped very soon a lady will appear. Her scent hangs already in the air, and birds on the boughs look inquiringly into the vacancy, ready to sing. In his two hands the young man holds a book. It is a book shaped like a heart. Cranmer sits on committees every day, in back rooms at Westminster. He's writing a paper for the king, to show that even if his brother's marriage to Catherine was not consummated, it does not affect the case for the annulment. For certainly they intended to be married, and that intention creates affinity. Also, in the nights they spent together, it must have been their intention to make children, even if they did not go about it the right way. In order not to make a liar out of Henry or Catherine, one or the other, the committee men think up circumstances in which the match may have been partly consummated or somewhat consummated, and to do this, they have to imagine every disaster and shame that can occur between a man and a woman alone in a room in the dark. Do you like the work? He inquires, looking at their hunched and dusty persons. He judges them to have the experience they need. Cranmer, in his writing, keeps calling the Queen the most serene Catherine, as if to separate her untroubled face, framed by a linen pillow, from the indignities being forced on her lower body, the boys fumbling and scrabbling, the pawing at her thighs. Meanwhile Anne, the hidden Queen of England, breaks free from her gentleman companions as she walks through a gallery at Whitehall. She laughs as she breaks into a trot, almost a skip, and they reach out to contain her, as if she is dangerous, but she flings their hands away from her, laughing, Do you know, I have a great longing to eat apples. The king says it means I am having a baby, but I tell him no, no, it can't be that. She whirls around, around again. She flushes, tears bounce out of her eyes and seem to fly away from her like the waters of an unregulated fountain. Thomas Wyatt pushes through the crowd. Anne, he snatches at her hands, he pulls her towards him. Anne, hush, sweetheart, hush. She collapses into hiccuping sobs, folding herself against his shoulder. Wyatt holds her fast. His eyes travel around, as if he had found himself naked in the road,
and is looking for some traveller to come along with a garment to cover his shame. Among the bystanders is Chapuis. The ambassador makes a rapid, purposeful exit, his little legs working, a sneer stamped on his face. So that's the news sped to the emperor. It would have been good if the old marriage were out, the new marriage in, confirmed to Europe before Anne's happy state were announced. But then, life is never perfect for the servant of a prince. As Thomas More used to say, we should not look to go to heaven on feather beds.
This ends Disc 14.